Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of The Dissenter. I'm your host, as always, Ricardo Lopes, and today I'm joined by Dr. Matty Hyra. He is professor of philosophy at Aalto University School of Business in Finland. He is the co-author of Antinatalism, Extinction, and the End of Procreative Self-Corruption, which we're going to talk about today. So, Matty, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure being here.
So I've already had a few conversations on the show with other authors about antinatalism, like, for example, David Benatar. But I would like to start by asking you, what is antinatalism? And perhaps looking back in history and into the contemporary formulations of antinatalism that we have, is there one single kind of antinatalism out there, multiple kinds? And if there are multiple kinds, what do they have in common?
Yes, there are multiple kinds, or at least multiple understandings of antinatalism. And the common feature is that they all question reproduction in one way or another. But when it comes to specifying whose reproduction should be questioned and what that means in practice, there are differences. So some say that we should only be talking about human procreation. Others would like to include other sentient or living beings. Some say that education and persuasion are all that we can do or should do, and others might condone more drastic or coercive methods of preventing people from having children.
And do we know how old antinatalism is in our Western tradition?
Well, they are the same age. Antinatalism is as old as the Western culture and perhaps older. Now, Karim Akerma, antinatalism's court philosopher and historian, has recently drawn our attention to an ancient Egyptian document, the Ipuwer Papyrus from the second millennia BCE. So that's long before any of the Greek stuff started. And that Papyrus is saying, would that there be an end of men without conception, without birth? Then would the land be quiet from noise and tumult be no more. So, as Akerma points out, this indicates that antinatalist sentiments were expressed even in writing already centuries before European civilization, so-called, started with the Greeks.
And since you mentioned the Greeks, they're going all the way back to them. What expressions of antinatalism can we find in their philosophy?
Well, in Sophocles, 6th century BCE, we find the figure of Silenus. Silenus was a mentor and companion of Dionysus, the god of wine. And Silenus had prophetic skills, and King Midas, the one who turned everything to gold by his touch, he asked Silenus what the best human lot would be. And the response, known as the wisdom of Silenus, was that it would be best not to be born at all. And if you are unlucky enough to be born, then the second best is to leave life as soon as possible. No one knows for sure what Silenus or what Sophocles was trying to say, but present-day antinatalists hail this as an early expression of the creed.
And what would be some of the other most prominent thinkers back then who argued for some form of antinatalism or some of its other related isms? And we're going to talk about some of those other isms later on in our conversation. But what were some of the other prominent thinkers?
Yes, first of all, it's not well-formed antinatalism back then during the 6th and 5th centuries BCE. But apart from Sophocles, other poets mention the wisdom of Silenus. There's Theognis of Megara in his elegies, and there's Euripides in his tragedies. And pre-Socratic philosophers also joined the party. Anaxagoras was questioning any higher meaning or purpose in life. And Thales of Miletus was saying that to love one's children means not having them. Now that's pretty antinatalist. And there are others, but it's quite scattered, and the context and meaning of the preserved fragments is often unclear.
So something that you also go through in your book is what you call antinatalist alarms. And could you tell us about the first one? What is it that you call the first antinatalist alarm?
Yes, the alarms. Amanda Sukenik and I identify two main points in the intellectual history of Europe that display, well, shall we say, stronger than usual manifestations of antinatalist ideas. The first took place in ancient Greece during the 5th and 4th centuries BCE, and one of the distinctive voices back then was Democritus, the founder of the atomistic school in philosophy. And he thought that the world is composed of matter, of small, invisible, indivisible particles that come together to form the visible and divisible object that we can see and hear and touch. And this is the scientific worldview that we still more or less accept. But Democritus also held the view that people, he and his peers presumably, should not have children of their own, because bringing them up is difficult and the results are uncertain. Anything can happen. So he said that if people must have children, then they should adopt children from their friends. And this way they could see the qualities of the new individuals before they take on the task of raising them.
And so you mentioned a scientific worldview there, then this sort of first antinatalism alarm relates to that, and perhaps in a way also gets amplified by a scientific worldview.
Amanda and I believe that the wisdom of Silenus and other similar fragments are based on a revelation, sort of. The revelation is that human life has no cosmic meaning. And Silenus can drown his sorrows in endless orgies, but in the harsh light of the morning, he will always confront an empty universe, devoid of purpose, if I am being poetic here. And now the scientific worldview suggested by Democritus amplified this lack of meaning by saying that there are only atoms and their movement in the world, and there are no caring gods who would take care of people and make their lives worthwhile. Democritus, no one at that time, denied the existence of God, but he said that gods are just another bunch of atoms living somewhere in a different place and not caring about humans at all. So variations of this revelation that life has no meaning have surfaced from time to time in the ensuing civilization.
So, in the book, you argue for a view that, quote, the history of Western philosophy as a 2.5 millennia reaction to antinatalist sentiments, and that, quote again, human life has no obvious meaning, and philosophers have been forced to build elaborate theories to invent imaginary purposes. So, could you give us perhaps a broad explanation for these, and then maybe later we can go through some of the history and get into more detail here?
Yes, sure. The work of Plato marks both the first reaction to an antinatalist alarm and the birth of European philosophy. And please note that this is interpretation and strong and unusual interpretation, as that the standard view is that philosophy has just gradually liberated revolutionary ideas like antinatalism from authoritarian tradition. But Amanda and I go tentatively against this view and say that since Plato, most Western philosophy has been a part of the problem rather than a part of the solution. And here goes our story. Now, Plato presented against the atomism of Democritus a story of how the world has come about, and how there is cosmic meaning in it after all. Now, according to Plato, and he is using a myth or a couple of myths, but myths in his time were understood as sort of scientific theories. So if you cannot explain it by your eyes and ears, then you can, if there's a suitable myth that could be the truth. Now, anyway, the myth is that the Earth and the planets and the stars and all living beings have been made by an artisan god, not exactly a creator, not creating anything from nothing, but a composer of things from already existing stuff. Now, this artisan god started the work from the stars and the planets and used all the good materials in shaping them. And when it came to producing people, only inferior stuff was available, and therefore we are imperfect. So now you know why you are imperfect, if you are, I don't know. Anyway, there is a cosmic plan for our perfection. Originally, in our deficient form, we all live on our own home stars. Everybody has an own home star, and we live in there. But in birth, we are transferred on Earth to become better. And if our lives go well, then we can complete the unity of our body, soul, and spirit, that's called justice, and then we become perfect. And when we die, we then go back to our home star, wow, and we live in bliss forever, contemplating the world of ideas high above this valley of the shadows. Quite a story then. But it comes from Plato, it comes from his work. And it gives meaning both to our lives and to having children. So we cannot leave people hanging in the stars in their imperfect forms. We have to bring them down here to complete their creation, left halfway by the artisan god. And that completion, that striving towards justice, that's the cosmic purpose of our lives. So here, well done, Plato. Antinatalism rejected, mission accomplished, godless atomists sent back to their dark corners.
So, and do we know what were the first reactions to antinatalism, or at least to ideas associated with antinatalism in the Western tradition, and who voiced them?
Yes, atomists soon recovered and came back. Epicurus was the main figure in the renewal and continued to argue that life and death have no particular meaning. The only thing we can do is to avoid pain and try to enjoy moderate pleasures, to be in harmony with ourselves, or in other words, to be happy. Epicureanism has, in a sense, lived to this day, but it has a bad name in many circles. The idea of seeking pleasure has been interpreted as living in lust and debauchery and generally being an immoral and nasty and detestable person. So traces of Epicureanism survive in utilitarian theories, but those have similar image problems.
So Epicureanism, it could have been something, I mean, a position in philosophy that could have carried Greek pessimism forward.
It could have. It's not impossible, but as we'll see, there were other disruptions in the way.
And talking about those disruptions, I mean, getting into the second antinatalist alarm, you focus on virtue and Christianity. What kind of virtue are you referring to here exactly, and how does it relate to antinatalism then?
Well, in our modern terms, a Victorian virtue or sexual virtue, we mean virtue in its carnal sexual sense. Some people thought 2,000 years ago, and many people still believe so, that sex is sinful and vicious and to be avoided by people of virtue. That's our sense.
And do you look at Christianity as also constituting a reaction to antinatalism? And if so, in what ways?
Well, that's the interesting bit, because Christianity in the beginning constituted an antinatalist reaction, the second antinatalist alarm, in fact. And there were two main elements in this. One, anything that has to do with flesh or our material being is bad or it's evil, and only the soul or the spirit can be pure and good. So having children requires sex. Sex is flesh. Flesh is evil, therefore don't have them. And two, Early Christian teaching was that the second coming of Jesus is near. It will happen during the lifetime of his contemporaries. So the teaching also was that the end times will be terrible, much persecution and suffering. Now, bringing children to that kind of world would have been unkind and in a word, insane.
But these were ideas that we can find among the early Christians, right?
In early Christianity, the Gnostics and the Manichaeans advocated antinatalism quite strongly for the reasons that I mentioned. And some fragments of those sects are still ongoing, but they are rather secretive and their current views on reproduction are not well known, at least to me. Now, there's always been something moving. During the 19th century, some Christian philosophers, notably the Danish existentialist Søren Kierkegaard, held distinctly antinatalist views, which is something that not everybody knows. Anyways, and as for modern development, there were for a while internet groups advocating Christian antinatalism, but they were small. And they seem to have disappeared now. And of course, official churches all take a very dim view on any such views, arguing that antinatalism is a godless doctrine that rejects God's greatest gift to humankind, the gift of life.
So, still on the topic of Christianity, in the book you also talk about the process of philosophizing Christianity. Tell us about that and what were some of the main reactions to both pro-natalism and antinatalism in that process?
Yeah, it's quite an interesting story. The Gnostics and the Manichaeans irritated official state-supported Christianity. And so something needed to be done about their challenge. Now, Augustine of Hippo produced a philosophical response that was loosely based on Plato's worldview. Amanda and I are not claiming that the church actually ordered this philosophy from Augustine, but there is a connection in there. Now, this time the meaning of human life was to complete the work of the Christian God. Remember that it was the artisan God whose work needed completion the last time around. Now it's the work of the Christian God, so not an almighty thing then. But whatever, we live our lives in whatever tedium or misery that we may face. But if we abide by the Christian God's rules, then after our death we get to enjoy everlasting bliss in heaven, or as Augustine called it, the city of God. Now, Augustine struggled a little with the teaching of Paul the Apostle, who had very critical views on sex, but so sex, flesh, blah, blah, blah. But in the end, Augustine took refuge in Paul's dictum, it is better to marry than to burn, and justified reproduction by that. Now, the entire passage in the letter to the Corinthians says, but if they do not have sufficient self-control, they should marry, for it's better to marry than to burn with passion. So Paul was pretty clearly frowning upon carnal relations, but somehow the Christian churches, starting with Augustine of Hippo, have been able to turn the fire on extramarital affairs only and not all sex and reproduction.
But so then there was a persecution of the Manichaeans and other Gnostics, right?
Yes, coincidentally with the philosophizing of Christianity after Augustine's work, all heretic sects were more or less persecuted to death, the methods including genocide were needed. Antinatalism was a really dangerous thing to believe in.
So, continuing on this history that we're exploring here, then you talk about a more recent reaction to unquestioned pronatalism that have occurred for the past 300 years or so. What characterizes this reaction that is based, as you say in the book, on happiness and freedom, and how does it relate to antinatalism?
Yes, the pendulum of antinatalist alarms or challenges and pronatalist reactions to them, they are still in motion. And yes, freedom and happiness and all that. I think that we'll return to all this later, if you don't mind.
Sure. In the book, you also say that, and this is going back to an earlier question related to the other isms that go associated with antinatalism, that it can be conceptually, morally, ideologically, and politically connected to these other isms and practices. I mean, perhaps let's go through the list here. So, starting with abortion, could you explain what's the
Obvious
connection?
prevents a birth.
And altruism.
If you believe that life is suffering, you don't bring new life in, lives into existence.
And animal rights.
And you can extend your altruism to non-humans by not bringing them into existence either.
So another one, atheism.
No God, no meaning. Why have children?
Ecology.
Ecology and environmentalism, no more children, no more increased environmental decay.
Egoism.
Or do you, like Democritus, just want to avoid the burden of raising your children and be egoistic about it?
And euthanasia.
If life is suffering, why continue it?
Extinctionism.
If no one has children, humankind will eventually cease to exist. So antinatalism will lead to it, according to most antinatalists.
So, I guess an unexpected one here, machine consciousness.
Well, if we produce sentient machines, and we are dangerously close to doing that, I mean, intelligence, artificial intelligence already says intelligence. Now sentience to that, and then. Well, it's a kind of reproduction. We are making machine babies at that point.
Natalism.
Well, natalism and pronatalism, they are opposites of antinatalism, so obviously.
Neocolonialism.
If only certain people should stop having children, the likely candidates in our current world will be the inhabitants of the global south. So neocolonialism, yes.
Nihilism.
If there is no meaning, can there be any values?
Pessimism.
The starting point of antinatalism, life is evil.
Pro-mortalism.
Promortalism and connected to that suicide, some antinatalists take the symmetrical view that if life should not be initiated, they should not be perpetuated either. It's a contested thing.
And the final one that I guess would also be connected to animal rights, veganism.
Yes, if you are an antinatalist because you want to avoid bringing about lives with suffering, then the idea of not exploiting non-humans in factory farming in any way for your own ends might appeal to you as well.
So, and among all of those in the book in section two, you decide to focus on extinctionism. Why did you decide to focus on this ism specifically?
It's so to speak, it's the elephant in the room of contemporary antinatalism. We know that it's there, but no one wants to talk about it. If no one has children, then humankind will cease to exist. Fact. But many people who call themselves antinatalists either deny this or try not to talk about it, and the idea seems to be too frightening somehow. So Amanda and I go through different scenarios and try to demonstrate that the idea is not that frightening, all things considered. If all human beings one day want to end reproduction, if big if, but if they want to do this, knowing that the species will a few decades later go extinct, then what's the problem? Of course, some people say that life is sacred and so on and so forth, but that's already covered. They will not agree to become antinatalists in the first place. That's bad for antinatalism, but has no effect on the original idea that universally voluntary human extinction, if you think about it and if you get the idea, it's very unlikely, but it's nothing to be scared of.
So, in order to explore more the idea of extinctionism and antinatalism more generally, let's talk about some common ideas in antinatalism here. So, What constitutes a good life and a bad life, and why does that matter for antinatalists?
Good question and hotly debated. I am myself on record saying that everybody should be allowed to determine the goodness or badness of their own lives for themselves. I have been wise early because that's in a 1990 publication on the quality of life, so I'm well covered here. So some antinatalists believe that all human or sentient lives are bad in an objective sense. And for them, this is a natural justification for their views. Lives are bad, don't create them.
And when it comes to being against reproduction, through which process do antinatalists arrive at that position? What philosophical path do you take exactly?
There is the all lives are bad approach. I have my doubts about that one simply because people are not buying it. They say, nonsense, my life is good and so is my neighbor's life. No use trying to convince them once they have made up their minds on that one. Then there's the children have not given their permission to be brought into existence tag. Again, I have my practical doubts. People are not getting that. They say, but I'm happy and grateful that I was brought into existence. Why wouldn't my children be? End of discussion. And finally, there is the so-called frisk argument. The word in the street seems to be that I presented its first formulation in 2004. I doubt that I was the first, but I'll take it. I'll take the accolade. Anyway, my point was that while lives can be good or they can be bad, you cannot know what your child's life would be like. Therefore, if you are a risk averse person, decision maker, then you don't have the child. And the usual objections to this are that a bit of badness is just what life is all about. Stop moaning. And that the probability of a truly horrible life is very, very small. We take risks like that every day crossing the streets, people say. Well, your question though was what philosophical path do you take? Now, the arguments from low quality of life credited to David Benatar, lack of consent credited to Anna Sifrin, and risk credited to me, they are all roughly consequentialist or outcome oriented. And apart from those, some maintain that being brought into a life that is manipulated by other people is a wrong. Julio Cabrera is the main name here. And Amanda and I have been moving into this Cabrera direction in our own way. Don't know with what success.
And in your view, would this position against reproduction extend to all sentient beings or only humans?
Well, the arguments from lack of consent and manipulation only apply to human beings because they are the ones who can consent and be manipulated in that sense. But the argument from quality of life and risk can easily be extended to all sentient beings, and both David Benatar and I do extend them.
What arguments do you use to support the voluntary extinction of our species, even going against some current ethical ideals?
Actually, I don't think that I need arguments to support the voluntary extinction of humankind. If no one objects to the idea, then again, what's the problem? What are the current ethical ideals now that I should be comparing this to? Well, two interpretations. One, avoidance of unnecessary suffering and respect for autonomy, the happiness and freedom that you mentioned earlier. No problem. They are compatible with antinatalism. And two, sanctity of life and the continuation of the species. The argument from there is just simply circular. We have to keep going because we have to keep going. So there's no mileage in that argument in my book.
And how would you characterize contemporary Western antinatalism?
I wouldn't. I don't know enough about the field, except that it's quite diverse and finding its feet. And our book is an attempt to focus the discussion a little. I may have initiated the argument from Risk 20 years ago, but the next I heard of antinatalism was 2 years ago when Amanda emailed me and asked me to her podcast program, telling me that I'm one of the greatest antinatalists of all time.
So let's get a little bit into arguments for and against having children. So what would you say are perhaps some of the most common and standard arguments for having children?
With this one, I just refer you to the very accessible An Antinatalist Handbook by Lawrence Anton, and the even more accessible The ABC of Antinatalism coloring book by Life Sucks. It's all told in those. So no pun intended, but life is too short to go here to go through all the excuses. It has always been done. God ordains it. Life is a gift. Your country needs more producers, consumers, and cannon fodder, and so on and so forth.
Okay, so perhaps what are the ones, or the ones that you'd say are the strongest against having children?
Well, I already listed the three main academic arguments, but the practical arguments, of course, range from the personal to the political. Children don't fit in my life plan. I would be a bad parent. The world is becoming a horrible place to live in. I cannot take the responsibility for a new life under these circumstances. You open a magazine's lifestyle section, and you will find these.
So we've covered basically procreation here, but what do you mean by procreative self-corruption in the book?
Well, if I may, first, Amanda and my argument in the book, we have a double argument in here, and
okay,
this leads me to procreative self-corruption.
Okay.
So our double argument is that first, anyone who reproduces opens up the possibility of further reproduction. Their children will have children, and so on and so forth. So sooner or later, some of the children's 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 children will have horrible lives. Not necessarily the first one, not necessarily your children, not necessarily their children, but further on down the line, it's inevitable. If this goes on, then somebody will have the horrible life. That's how life goes. And it is, we are assuming that kind of a notion of responsibility, it's your fault. Don't do it. So secondly, you can then raise your children to be antinatalist. You can stop the chain by like that. So now you have the children, you make sure that they are happy, and you make sure that they will never have children. But you are very unlikely to do so, because if you have brought meaning into your own life by reproducing, you probably want your children to have the same opportunity. And you want them to think that you are a good person. So in all likelihood, you will bring them up to be pronatalists like yourself. And in doing so, you impose your pronatalist mentality and lifestyle on them when they are too young to form their views for themselves. You manipulate them into being your mental clones. This is where I and Amanda come close to Julio Cabrera. Then what do we mean by procreative self-corruption? Well, as Amanda and I define it, it's a combination of the two factors: opening up the possibility of the horrible life sometime in the future, and having to resort to manipulating your children in reproductive matters. So by having a child and then having to make decisions about its upbringing, you corrupt yourself in at least one of three ways. You make yourself responsible for a horrible future life, you force your children to do the same, or you force your children to be antinatalists and thereby deprive them of the happiness that you have yourself achieved. That was helpful.
Could you explain this concept of need frustration? I mean, what does it mean in your view, and what do you consider right and wrong in regards to it?
Certainly. Basic need frustration can be seen as the only thing that is bad in itself. It's the only intrinsic negative value. If what I do does not lead to anyone's basic need frustration, then good and fine, I'm allowed to do it. But if what I do does lead to someone else's basic need frustration, then I'm probably not allowed to do it. Now, by reproducing I, one, open the pathway to the horrible future life of suffering, and two, force myself to manipulate my children either to an antinatalist mindset to close the pathway or to a pronatalist mindset to keep them happy. Now, suffering and being manipulated are, I believe, the main forms of basic need frustration. Therefore, I should not reproduce.
So in the book, you also criticize some of the most popular current arguments for antinatalism. So let's go through each of them and then talk about the alternative you suggest. Starting with arguments from poor quality of life, what do you make of them? Are they convincing at all or not?
They are convincing to me personally. I believe that no life would have been better than my life. What I don't believe is that people in general would be convinced by this. Life is good, they say, and that's the end of the argument.
And what about the asymmetry of good and bad?
This is implied in my need approach. We should not bring about bad lives, even the eventual future bad life, because that would involve causing bad, allowing basic need frustration in my vocabulary. Now, some say that we should bring about good lives, though. The argument from asymmetry has it that while there is an obligation to avoid bringing about bad lives, there is no corresponding duty to promote bringing about good ones. And I say that we have no obligation to do so because non-existent beings don't have any needs. So I think that my way is more elegant, and I must drop a year again, 1994, in my book Liberal Utilitarianism and Applied Ethics. In a footnote, I say exactly that there is no need to become into existence. So no need-based argument about this. So the basic needs of those who don't exist cannot be frustrated simply because they don't have any. They are not there. There's no one there. But I can understand this. And looking into your eyes, I can see that you understand this. But this argument is far, 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 far too complicated for members of the general public to understand. Nonsense, they say. I'm happy to be alive, and so would my unborn children. And denying them that happiness means frustrating their needs, whatever you say, Mr. Philosopher Smarty Pants. And no amount of argumentation will change their minds. So no asymmetry for them, I think.
So perhaps another kind of argument that it's also hard for the general public to understand. What do you make of arguments based on the lack of consent?
Yes, like the other two, it's just unintuitive. Non-existing individuals cannot consent to being born. No, but they cannot consent to not being born either. So talking about consent in their case seems to be somehow off target or even ridiculous. It does have a place somewhere in the antinatalist argumentation. It does have a distinct place in there, but it's just too complicated to be used outside the specialist discussion, or that's what I think.
So getting into your alternative argument then, you say that, quote, near universal meaning in life can be secured, but only by imposing a pronatalist lifestyle upon new individuals in a manipulative way that we should no longer consider attractive or acceptable. So could you explain the argument here and what would be exactly the antinatalist argument?
Yes. Our whole book is based on the premise that European culture has been in search of meaning or the duration of its existence. The wisdom of Silenus and other expressions of ancient Greek pessimism evidence that people felt an absence of a greater purpose. Plato's theory explained that we are here to complete an artisan God's work, and Augustine of Hippo's version of Christianity said the same in terms of the Christian God. We are actors, characters in a divine comedy, and it is our job to make God great again. We can use that slogan somewhere. Well, in time, of course, religion faded away from people's minds, and the image of God grew, even in the minds of those who believed in God, the image of God grew weaker and weaker. So in the secularized parts of the world, no one can seriously argue that the meaning of our lives is to have children to please God. Doesn't work like that. And this raises the question, where should we find the meaning then? And the current response, as far as I can see, as far as I can see with Amanda, seems to be in self-fulfillment through having offspring. That's the lifestyle section answer today.
So, when it comes to finding purpose or meaning in life, what would you say would be the main differences between doing it via a pro-natalist route versus an anti-natalist route?
Ah, there's a difference there. Antinatalists don't have to find a bigger cosmic meaning to their lives. Life can be just about bearable, but it is void of meaning and purpose. So let's get rid of it by stopping reproduction at least. It's only the poor pronatalists who have to struggle here. They want life to continue, but to what avail? They have to find a purpose, a meaning. And if philosophy and theology don't help, then it must be in the activity itself. Making more life is meaningful because making more life gives our life its meaning. It's circular, but there you go.
So, taking into account what we talked about earlier when it comes to the main current arguments in antinatalism and how they are difficult for the general public to understand, they are really unintuitive. In what ways would you say your argument here could strengthen the antinatalism movement?
It's early days yet to say anything about that. Amanda and I have been working together only a couple of years, and we are still looking for the perfect, convincing, understandable argument for antinatalism. The idea of not having children is so strange to most people that it's difficult to express it in a palatable form. I think that the risk part of our argument, that parents make themselves responsible for a very bad life somewhere in the future, it could resonate with quite a few in these times of political turmoil and ecological decay, of course. The manipulation part of the argument is a harder sell. It's basically claiming that parents commit their children to procreative slavery. So I'm not really holding my breath in there.
So finally, in the book, you go through some of, or perhaps all of, the possible routes for, as you say, ending procreative self-corruption and having an antinatalist society. So let's talk about them, starting with the big yellow button or technological removal of suffering. What would these look
Oh,
like?
the 13 ways and means that we list. Okay, so the big yellow button, technological removal of suffering. Right, the David Pearce solution. We cannot make people to stop having children, so let's stop suffering in some other way by medicine and technology. In the book, I think that Amanda and I just say that this is not going to happen. It just isn't. On hindsight, I would add to this, that even if it were successful, then it would not remove the problem of parental manipulation. But that's the topic of some future book or article.
So another button, the big orange button. This one is about immortality by biomedical gerontology. What do you make of it?
Yes, it's a way of being anti-natalist, but avoiding the demise, or at least the quick demise of humankind. So no more children, but people live forever, if not met by external violence, of course. So it's a nice idea if you happen to like it. Go for it if you must, as long as you don't have children.
And the big red button, obliteration of humankind.
Yes, well, That would solve the problem of suffering once and for all. I am a voluntary human extinctionist myself, so I would say go ahead if no one objects. Then again, someone will object. There's an ongoing discussion within certain antinatalist circles on the advisability of talking about this opinion publicly at all.
So we have a few more buttons here. The violet one is immigration to virtual reality.
So this would mean uploading our minds to a computer world and living forever in digital or in the future, whatever more advanced bliss. Well, aren't we already? But anyway, our quite innovative, if I say so myself, objection to this one was that it would be a form of reproduction, if it's brought to its conclusion. Our minds would not be moved to virtual reality in this mind uploading. Instead, we would die, and someone else would have to assume a life based partly on our experiences. So, in other words, that would not be antinatalism at all.
So, two more buttons. The blue one is irreversible collective infertility. What is that about?
Yes, it's an alternative to the big red button. It would be kinder to let people live out their lives just not having children. And that's the point there. And if I recall, our reaction to this was yuck. Really? So instead of a nice clean demise, you would commit the remaining generations to meaningless misery for the rest of their lives. So not our cup of tea.
So, and the last button before we move on to other alternatives, the big green button, humankind makes room for other species.
Yes, Patricia McCormack's brilliant abolitionist vitalism. Humankind dies away voluntarily, but with its last caring practices leaves a mark and lives on in the harmonious without humans world to come. We didn't quite see how that would be done in practice, but yeah, go for it, I say now. Anything without reproduction.
And then there's also other alternatives like antinatalist super women or super men. What does this mean?
Yeah, that would be a person with superpowers who comes to the rescue, devises an antinatalist plan, gets everyone to accept, and off we go, literally. Wonderful, of course, but let's say highly improbable.
And what about an antinatalist dictatorship?
Unfortunately, that one is a more probable scenario, and it's not a good one. Lots of suffering, uncertain outcome. I wouldn't suggest it.
And then there's also the idea of an antinatalist cult or religion. What do you think about it?
Well, it was already tried by the Gnostics and the Manichaeans and ended up in tears, but different time it might work. A nice new age movement towards antinatalism. Who knows? Someone could try.
Then one that would probably be a little bit more palatable to modern ears, antinatalist liberal democracy.
Yeah, this is not in sight for the time being. That's the problem. I wouldn't mind, but the world doesn't really seem to be developing into that direction, or is it? I mean, more freedom of opinion, reproductive autonomy, coming back to your freedom and happiness again, realization of the horrors of the world. Well, maybe something is brewing. It would be nice.
And what about rational persuasion? Do you think that could work?
It is the only ethical way to proceed. It doesn't seem to be working fantastically, but perhaps it's early days yet. Perhaps liberal democracy and rational persuasion together will move people's minds. So we have to believe in that to continue this work. So fingers crossed.
And there's also the alternative of cunning of reason. What is that
Yes,
about?
the cunning of reason is at the same time the most difficult and the easiest idea to explain. Now, the most difficult is that it's philosophical. Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, the 18th and 19th century German philosopher, suggested that the world is developing pretty much without human intention. There are ideas that clash and develop, but humankind is, for all intents and purposes, just a spectator in this play. In the end, according to Hegel, freedom will be victorious, and we can only admire its blossoming from the audience. Well, be that as it may, in the real world, the idea is simple. Whatever we think we are doing, bigger forces are already moving us towards the end of reproduction. People's self-interest reduce birth rates. Pollution reduces sperm counts. Education reduces women's willingness to have children, and so on. So, according to this cunning of reason thing, we don't have to do anything about it. Antinatalism is already on the way.
So one final root then, the root of the benevolent machine.
Yes. And finally, the technological version of the cunning of reason. Machine intelligence, so-called, is increasing in efficiency and scope. And sooner or later, it is predicted that there will be a computer that is who is cleverer and kinder than we are. And that computer, if it has access to everything else in the world, can decide to help humankind. The machine thinks people will never on their own stop their suffering, so they need assistance. And then the benevolent, omnipotent machine presses the big red button, and we are all history. Oh, happy day.
So let me just ask you one last question. This will be the last question of our conversation today. And regarding these different possible routes, which are the ones that you would support the most? Do you think that any of them is superior to all the others, or would you support perhaps a combination of them?
Rational persuasion is the only thing that we can explicitly do. And then, of course, follow the developments of, is there a cult coming somewhere? Is there, in liberal democracy, are there tendencies that go towards antinatalism? And then the answer for now is no, there are not, because it isn't happening in the global south and in the global north. We are now worrying about the population, the native population of our own country. So, rational persuasion.
Okay, so the book is again Antinatalism, Extinction, and the End of Procreative Self-Corruption. I'm leaving a link to it in the description box of the interview. And Mati, apart from the book, would you like to tell people where they can find you and the rest of your work on the internet?
I think that the Exploring Antinatalism podcast site has all my exploits listed somewhere, probably in the Exploring Antinatalism podcast number 65, which is the first episode that Amanda and I did together. I think that in the comments of that, there are whatever they are called, citation trees or source trees or whatever, all the millions of things that I've done in my life.
Great. So thank you so much again for taking the time to come on the show. It's been a great pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you, Ricardo. It has been my pleasure and honor.
Hi, guys. Thank you for watching this interview until the end. If you liked it, please share it, leave a like, and hit the subscription button. This show is brought to you by Enlights, learning and development done differently. Check their website at enlights.com. And also, please consider supporting the show on Patreon or PayPal. I would also like to give a huge thank you to my main patrons and PayPal supporters: Per-Ergo Larsen, Jerry Muller, Hans Fredrik Sunde, Bernard Seixas, Olaf Alex, Adam Kessel, Matthew Whittingbird, Arno Wolf, Tim Hollis, Eric Alenia, John Connors, Philip Force Connolly, Dan Demetri, Robert Windegar, Rui Inácio, Zup, Marco Neves, Colin Holbrook, Phil Kavanagh, Mikkel Stormir, Samuel Andrew, Francis Ford, Tiago Nunes, Fergal Cousin, Hal Herzog, Nuno Machado, Jonathan Liebrandt, João Linhares, Stanton T, Samuel Correa, Eric Hines, Mark Smith, João Leira, Tom Hummel, Sardes France, David Sloan Wilson, Yassi Lades Araújo, Romain Roach, Diego Londoño Correa, Yannick Punter, Adana Rusmani, Charlotte Bliss, Nicole Barbaro, Adam Hunt, Pavel Stasevski, Nelek Bak, Guy Madison, Gary G. Allman, Sam Afzal, Adrian Yeagy, Paul Tolentino, João Barbosa, Julian Price, Edward Hall, Edin Bronner, Douglas Fry, Franca Bortolotti, Gabriel Pons Cortez, Ursula Litsky, Scott, Zachary Fish, Tim Duffy, Sonny Smith, John Wiseman, Daniel Friedman, William Buckner, Paul George Arnaud, Luke Loaki, Georgios Theofanos, Chris Williamson, Peter Wolosin, David Williams, Diogo Costa, Anton Eriksson, Charles de Murray, Alex Shaw, Maury Martinez, Coralie Chevalier, Bangalore Atheists, Larry Dealey Jr., Old Erringbon, Sterry, Michael Bailey, Dan Sperber, Robert Gracie, Igor N., Jeff McMahon, Jake Zuhl, Barnabas Radix, Mark Campbell, Thomas Dovner, Luke Nissen, Chris Story, Kimberly Johnson, Benjamin Galbert, Jessica Nowicki, Linda Brandon, Nicholas Carlson, Ismael Benzliman, George Koryatis, Valentin Steinman, Per Krollis, Kate Van Goller, Alexander Hubbard, Liam Dunaway, B.R., Masood Ali Mohammadi, Perpendicular, Jonas Hertner, Ursula Goodenough, Gregory Hastings, David Pinsoff, Sean Nelson, Mike Levine, and Jos Necht. A special thanks to my producers, Isar Webb, Jim Frank, Lucas Stefaniak, Tom Vanagden, Bernard Igni, Curtis Dixon, Benedict Mueller, Thomas Trumbull, Catherine and Patrick Tobin, Giancarlo Montenegro, Alni Cortez and Nick Golden, and to my executive producers, Matthew Lavender, Sergio Quadriano, Bogdan Canivets, and Rosie. Thank you for all.